You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up. Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life. It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Let's ride!
Good evening, everybody. It's 7:01 p.m. and how the fuck you doing? It's quite frankly, I'm Frank. I told myself I was going to stop cursing a couple of weeks ago. Hasn't worked out too well. Well, consider the subject matter. We're in the middle of hell. We're going to hell in a fast car. We're in the back seat laughing the whole way, but sometimes we're crying, sometimes we're screaming. Last night was a debate. We'll talk about that in the second half of the show. The first half of the show is a little bit more apropos. We're having a hypnotherapist on tonight. Going to get that around to that. Dr. Irwin. Dr. Nancy Irwin is going to come on with us tonight. She is a primary therapist and addiction specialist, but she uses hypnotherapy. So I want to talk about hypnosis a little bit. She also is a certified practitioner of neuro-linguistic programming, NLP, which I know that she applies all this practice in the sense of addiction and overcoming addiction. But NLP is a very, very well-known mind control or mind-influencing mechanism. Okay, NLP is actually even paid reference to or documented in different types of movies like Eyes Wide Shut. I'm going to bring that up tonight. I've got notes. You guys can put whatever you want in the chat room. That's another thing you can do. Tomorrow night is going to be a good night. It's going to be Tim Pool's first night on air here in the studio. He's going to be streaming to his YouTube, though. But that'll be right after, quite frankly. And I don't know. Like, you know, I just got to be honest with you guys. Last night was shitty. The debate, I don't know what it was. I felt like, oh, guys, this is amazing. This is history. It's going to happen. Because, you know, like we said before, you watch a series long enough, you got to see the finale. So I'm just glad this is over. I'm glad it's almost over. I don't care. I just don't care. Watching that last night, I just don't care who's president anymore. Don't care. I don't know about you guys. I don't care. What the fuck does it matter? No, seriously, Matt. What the fuck does it matter? You tell me what the fuck it matters at this point. And you know what? Donald Trump slips in and he delays the inevitable for 4 years until this relentless globalist movement cabal.
He can give us more time to prepare for it.
Yeah, more time to prepare. We've had the last 20 years to prepare for something. Nothing. Ain't nothing happened. Nothing. Last 20 years of bullshit and expansion, before and after 9/11. What the hell are we preparing for? It's all done. The executive branch has swollen to the size of a watermelon. Well, I guess watermelon is small compared to the size of a government. So you know what I mean. Elephantitis. We've got elephantitis of the executive branch. The legislative branch has been overwhelmed by the executive branch and the duopoly between the executive powers and the kangaroo court that has become the Supreme Court and all the circuits. And once Hillary Clinton gets in there and starts naming judges that will last for the next 30 years, then what the fuck you have? Yeah, it's just, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Frank, you're so negative. We can't start off that way.
I gotta get it out. I gotta get this shit out.
I don't believe in any of it anymore. I don't believe in any of it anymore. I'm starting to lose it. And the one thing I'm happy I didn't do is I didn't go on Facebook. I didn't watch the dozens of imbeciles that I have in my life. Those that I know and those that I didn't see. That's another reason why that I didn't go on Facebook and check out what everybody had to say. Because I don't want to know who the imbeciles in my life are. Okay? If I gotta bump into you in the AMP, I gotta bump into you at Dunkin' Donuts sometime. I want to at least still remember you the way that you were. Okay? That's a good reason to get off of Facebook. Remember people the way that they were before they died and went to digital hell. Jesus. You're talking about the hereafter. Facebook is hell. Let's see who's in the chat room. What's going on, Mootlin Matt? Nikki, Rumble and Roar. My Brain on Me. Johnny Broom, Murr, a couple other people that are in there that are just hanging out. Enjoy your nights. I hope everybody has a great night. Let's see if I still have the interview magic bug. Let's see if I can still put together a good interview. But I have my notes here. I got my notes for Dr. Irwin. But after that, I have my notes for the debate. I want to hear what you guys have to say about the debate. In short, the first 30 to 45 minutes, Trump was on the money. And he was really giving it to her. And then the last 30 to 40 minutes, he just tailspin. It was a tailspin. If you're unbiased and you're watching it, I mean, I have my biases, but I'm going to sit there and I'm going to say, eek. I'm going to say, nah. It's not like rooting for the Yankees where they're in the bottom of the eighth and they're losing by two. And you're like, it's all right. They still got a chance. No, I'm not rooting for anybody. I'm not rooting for anybody. It's funny because you say, well, you're not rooting for anybody, but you're rooting against Hillary Clinton. So you are de facto rooting for Trump. But, you know, here's a real thing. I think that really takes people down to their core when it comes to all this political bullshit. When we get into, I can't wait until it's over just because we can start talking about other things. You know, of course, there's going to be social justice issues that will always be laughable. And for all you social justice warriors out there, let me just remind you, you are laughable. Laughable. You could try all the physical intimidation you want. You can get in people's faces. You could do your clapping. You could do your clapping while you talk, all that bullshit. You're laughable. Okay? All you have left is to hit people. Go ahead. Let's start the swinging war. Let's start that phase of the battle. All you have left is to hit people. You want to see some of these crazy assholes? We got 3 minutes. Social justice warriors. I guess these are in the same camp. Here's a campaign. Where is this? In France or something like that? In Frankfurt. Okay. Here are a bunch of vegans going out, getting branded with hot irons in public to protest animal cruelty. You want to see absolute lunacy. Watch this. This is from RT. Check this shit. Okay, it is Paris. Look. You hear that bitch scream? Thank you. Oh, good. Oh, great. Good job. Look at this. Hold on a second. Let's see if they do this over again. So, look at this. This freak has this chick by a collar of chain. It's a chain link collar around her neck. And he's corralling her and whipping her around, I guess, like a poor animal. Like a poor animal that she actually is. And she gets whipped around, thrown into this tent in public. She gets laid down. And now someone gets a blowtorch. They're making it nice and hot, this brand. And boom, legs. 269. Look at all these freaks. Look at this. What is this lunacy? Look, hold on a second. Look at these freaks laying around on the sidewalk. Freaks. These are not people to be emulated, kids. Kids, these are not people to be emulated. These are psychotics. Getting themselves branded. Can you imagine walking down the sidewalk and smelling burning flesh? And it's the leftist animal activists in that tent over there by the fountain burning each other because somewhere else in the world animals are being slaughtered, so they burn each other in a public square. Do you understand the lunacy of this narcissistic bullshit? This look at me bullshit. Didn't I stand for something great? Pat me on the back. No, the other shoulder. I just branded that one. Fucking idiots. You're a bunch of lunatics. I'm in a mood tonight. I've got to control myself. I've got 120 seconds before I have to call Dr. Nancy Irwin. I have to control myself. Okay. Dr. Irwin is also the author of U-Turn, Changing Direction in Midlife, 2008, a collection of over 40 stories of people over 40 who made amazing transitions in midlife, and has been featured in a wide variety of media outlets, including CNN, CNBC, Fox, and MSNBC. She's a certified practitioner of EMDR, that's eye movement desensitization, I probably didn't say it right, and reprocessing, neuro-linguistic programming, which we just mentioned before, timeline therapy, and emotion-free therapy. Dr. Irwin tailors each client's treatments to the effect most rapid transformation possible. So I can't wait to ask her about a couple of those lines of therapy because it's just... What the hell's timeline therapy? Is that like past life regression? Got to ask her. We'll do all these things. In fact, let's do them right now. It's ringing. And joining us live right now is Dr. Nancy Irwin. Dr. Nancy, how are you?
I'm great, Frank. Thank you.
Oh, it's so awesome to have you with us here tonight because I got to say, first of all, your line of work is very, very fascinating to me. It has always been fascinating to me. But there's also, I can't believe all the different types of certifications and therapy methods I have here listed in your bio. Some of them sound so interesting. I would just like to get into the middle of that, just in the middle of those methodologies, if you don't mind.
I don't mind at all. Jump on in.
Well, first of all, we were just talking about your book from 2008, U-Turn. That's an amazing premise. And you're actually not the first addiction specialist we've had on the air with us on this show. So we already have a little bit of a basis of the type of work you probably are doing. But yours is so different than the rest because of the hypnotherapy. I can't wait to ask you about that. Now, the first thing is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. Can you give us a little bit of a nutshell on what that kind of therapy entails?
Absolutely. EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, is specifically a trauma modality. We find that probably 90 to 95% of our clients who suffer from addictions have trauma in the background. So when we get to the root of an issue, it's almost like the addictive behavior has been a symptom and it's easier for that to fall away. EMDR works in a nutshell, and actually the woman who created it can't even explain it fully scientifically. All we know is after about 30, 35 years, it's highly effective. We get a lot of results. It's simply a trauma gets stored in the brain as sort of a block of ice. And EMDR sort of melts that away and allows the neural pathways and the body and brain's energy to flow again. So by a system of attacking the targets, the upset, the traumas that an individual suffered, sometimes it takes several sessions, but we do a system of bilateral stimulations where their eyes are following my fingers. It's like watching a ping pong match. And through this process, and I'm giving you the nutshell version, it's a little more complex than that.
No, it's okay.
It again melts away the tension, and the client will remember the event, but they won't have the sting in their body that has blocked them.
You're saying like a block of ice. So the first thing I'm thinking of, obviously, it's not any kind of a physical thing that's going on inside the brain, but is it more so the root of our pain that we sometimes we build walls around and try to really hide away? Is that really what it is? Is it those psychological walls that we build up that's the real blockage you're talking about, or is this a physical thing?
Yes, and it can actually be physical as well, because it's sometimes hard to separate the mind from the body. Mm. But we have visceral reactions to certain events, certain aspects that we have a negative association with a traumatic experience. For example, God forbid someone is raped wearing a blue dress in a stadium. If they see a blue dress in a stadium, that may trigger that, and they'll actually have a visceral reaction to it.
Right.
So it's certainly a powerful storage of negative information in the brain that we try to clear out, if you will.
You know, what you said the word triggered. Now, that has become almost like a joke on the internet these days, because people like to put out there their trigger warnings and what they don't like to hear. And, you know, like most things, the commoner takes a word that is probably, you know, that has some validity and credibility in a profession such as yours, and they make it, have you seen this, where people are taking the word trigger and all these little things that they may just not like as far as personal taste goes, and they turn it into this, their own hyped up visceral reaction in a way to stifle free speech? What do you have any of that you've encountered in your personal practice?
Absolutely, and anything can become cliche. And hey, a lot of people have that same sort of reaction to being called an addict. So we try to avoid that, and we say someone who has suffered an addiction or things like that. And I certainly respect that if somebody has that. I just use the word myself because the layman understands that. You could just say you have a negative association or an undesirable reaction to some event or stimuli around you.
Well, my next question is actually on the next method that you use, and it's NLP. Now, neuro-linguistic programming is something that we are familiar with over here, but of course, it's in a little bit more of a conspiratorial sense. NLP pops up a lot when we're talking about secret societies and people around the world who know how to manipulate and influence people around them. Even when it comes down to, I mean, there's been books that published on NLP to help guys pick up women. So, so I'm just wondering, you know, give us a little bit of a breakdown on the clinical application of NLP, because we know all the dark side stuff.
Okay. And I guess your viewers understand NLP stands for neuro-linguistic programming, and it's just what it is. The neural pathways respond to certain cues, certain language associations, and they're programmed. From birth, we have a certain reaction to certain words, and we certainly learn those the older we get. So NLP, through a system of embedding suggestions, and you do this not in a manipulative way, although you could call it a positively manipulative way when it comes to freeing one from addictions, but it sort of scrambles the encoding in the person's brain so that it gets harder and harder to access the old neural pathway, sort of like a wagon rut, the grooves that the wagon wheel will make in the dirt road. Mm. So we sort of change that. We fill it up and we create a new neural pathway. So it's used for positive intents. Of course, a lot of salesmen have been trained to use it to be very, very persuasive, shall we say. And of course, we use it in the addictions field, obviously only when the client is willing and ready to change and understands how to support themselves by using this powerful modality.
Would you be able to give an example of how NLP has helped a client or a person in changing that way of thinking?
Absolutely. I use this with my smoking cessation package like 100% of the time. Does anything work for everyone? No. But I get a 90% success rate in conjunction with a lot of other techniques as well in hypnosis. But the fast phobia cure is a very rapid way to rewind the old programming, essentially see cigarette, salivate, light it up, smoke it, enjoy it. So we rewind that and lay down a whole new programming. I'm putting this again in a nutshell, where we change that so that the person will have the reaction they'd like to have to the cigarette, which is to laugh at it, to walk on by it, to be disgusted, to sort of gag and walk on and have a glass of water, or to sing or throw some hoops or whatever they want to do to resist that old urge.
That really is interesting right there. Yeah. And as far as addiction goes in general, you know, Dr. Irwin, I'm a writer and I have this show, this nightly show, so it's a big part of my everyday job, I'd say, to make observations and lay down commentary on what I see. The scariest type of addiction that I'm seeing these days, that I would love to get a little bit more of your personal take on, is the addiction of social media or media just in general. How common is this in your practice, and have you any success in treating it?
I treat a great deal of porn addiction. Haven't seen so much social media addiction because I think it's still too new and people really aren't identifying it as such, nor are they really ready to give it up. But porn addiction, absolutely. That's wrecked a lot of relationships and a lot of lives and has led to a lot of arrests, quite frankly. So I do get a call for that quite often.
And now people seem to be – the other thing I see is that people seem to be becoming – more involved on a political level, especially when it comes to, you're talking about social media. A lot of the things that I see happening are people becoming a little bit more politicized, but they're also, I think that it's not so much as an intellectual awakening so much as it is a zombified type of behavior. So when I look at social media, it's not so much that it's like, okay, well, look at these people who are addicted to reading the encyclopedia. Look at these people who are addicted to studying this topic and all that stuff, and they're going off and they're in coffee houses debating the news of the day. I see a zombie-like behavior coming out of people these days. And, you know, they repeat and parrot and react. There's not a lot of thinking. I mean, are tried and tested hypnosis techniques being used by the media on a mass scale? Do you see that at all?
Well, here's the deal. You could say that hypnosis is everywhere. Mm. There's a thing called mass hypnosis, which we all know. And my personal belief is, oh my gosh, all the media, no insult intended, of course, it can be used for good as opposed to evil. Anything can be very addictive and put one in a hypnotic state. Hypnosis simply means, well, it's the Greek for sleep, but in that state, you're taking a suggestion. When someone comes in the clinic and they're paying me to help them, it only works because it's their goal. So when people are using social media, they're taking a suggestion that they obviously want at that time. If they choose to be free of that or curtail it or be in control of it, that I can help them too. But it is important to know that really everything is hypnosis. Movies, complete hypnosis. Advertising is complete hypnosis. Living in a society, we're constantly taking suggestions, laws, the whole legal system. Most of it is good, of course, but they're all suggestions. You don't have to obey the laws. You don't have to take that suggestion. There are consequences if you don't. So in a sense, everything is hypnosis.
The picture that you just painted right there with the complexities and the nuance that we have to live in and around all the time, I can actually see why people are breaking down. I mean, how the hell, you know, you turn a corner and you might be breaking some kind of a rule. You turn a corner, you have five life or death decisions to making. You turn a corner, you have an election. You turn a corner, you have this and that. It's really unbelievable. And then, you know, as far as the porn goes, does that start off as like one of those escapes from all the rest of the other things? You know, how does that really, what does that usually start off as, that it balloons into something else and then you're just on it constantly?
It's usually stemming from someone wanting to pleasure themselves in a non-contact way. The detriment comes if their relationship is not upholding that. In other words, there's not agreement with their partner. And they begin to relate more to fantasy than reality, because porn is not about real people. It's one dimension, and it's completely exaggerated toward perfection, and that ain't reality. And then people can get addicted to it, especially if they have social anxiety, intimacy issues, fear of intimacy, the quote-unquote typical loner. Very easy for them to get addicted to that.
Let me ask you, still on that, because here's another story, a storyline and a conclusion that I have heard and seen come out of so many different situations, especially when it comes to porn addiction, where somebody will start off, you know, and they're looking up just regular, you know, regular old missionary sex.
Sure.
And then all of a sudden, a couple of years later, when they are eventually busted or something happens, they're into snuff films. They're into things that are so far beyond the pale of anything you can consider normal human sexual behavior. You know how that slippery slope just kind of exists there? Yeah. Where does it start and what accelerates it?
Well, it depends on a lot of factors in the person's life, but there is a parallel to drug addictions, one's tolerance level increasing. So you can do the same thing with sexuality, with pornography. And also, there's so much stuff floating around, you never know what you're going to open. And I used to work with sex offenders. I had plenty of guys who thought they were opening straight porn, and kiddie porn slipped in there. And you can't get out of an arrest for that. They seize your computer, and it stays on there forever. So I caution people to be very, very careful about what sort of porn they're opening.
It's really unbelievable out there. It really is.
Yeah. It is. So I think wise people have to set up boundaries for themselves, not only with watching porn, but also with social media. What is the right amount? Personally, not that I'm the queen of this, but I don't put more than about 30 minutes into emails, Twitter, Facebook, all that per day. It is very easy to get pulled into it if you don't have other activities and you don't have a boundary setting of how much time is appropriate. Same thing with TV watching. A lot of people regulate their children no more than 2 hours a day so they don't turn into this TV addict.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's what I need. I think I need to put up some I need to put up some rules for myself too. The problem is that the social media, you do so much work on it. If your work actually requires you to be on it, I think that's the worst part about it. So many things are powered and are spread and are promoted through social media that even if you want to get away from it sometimes, you're going to be touching it somehow. You're either using a corporate account or you're using your own. So,
sure.
I don't know. Now, you're a primary therapist at Seasons Recovery Centers.
Yes, happy to be on staff there.
Now, tell me about the work that you guys do over there.
Well, we are an inpatient and an outpatient alcohol and substance abuse recovery center, luxury treatment center in Malibu. We do treat other addictions, such as sexual addictions, gambling, also trauma and depressive disorders, but we mostly treat substance and alcohol. Typically, a client will stay for 30 days. Many stay longer, many stay briefer. We can detox them, and then we give them intense psychotherapy. Depending on the package they get, it's 2 to 3 sessions of individual therapy. They may choose to have hypnosis. They get acupuncture. They have physical activities, a whole range of things from beach walks to Muay Thai to horseback riding to golfing, tennis. Working out with a personal trainer, yoga, all sorts of wonderful other modalities. We have an art therapist. We have several groups. We have a trauma group, a men's group, a women's group. I'm sure I'm forgetting something. A healthy relationships group. I do a dream analysis group. So there's a little something for everyone. And by the time they leave, they should have a whole full toolkit of things that work for them. And know exactly, they have an exit plan so that they, when they return, when they get off the pink cloud, if you will, they're ready for life again. They created another future for themselves, which is something I do in hypnosis. Many people come in and they fit into the negative beliefs about being an addict or a junkie or all these other, you know, disparaging labels. And I like to look at it as, you know, you're not a bad person. You've had some bad behaviors. But let's look at who you're really meant to be and create that clear vision and a way to stay in action to achieve that. easier said than done, of course, but you have a lot of support and you set up all the proper checks and balances in your life, if you will, a strong support system. Perhaps it's 12-step programs, continuing therapy, couples counseling, more exploration of trauma, a spiritual path. Every situation is different, and we respect each individual on their path and create a whole program for them. We're not a cookie-cutter outfit.
Well, let me ask you something about your success rates. Now, I'm going to ask specifically just so we don't get too broad, but we have a really big problem now. The heroin epidemic in this country is going out of – it's just skyrocketing again. Some states are hit harder than others, but I mean, I don't know how many high school overdoses we've had over here in our neck of the woods in Westchester County over the last couple of years. In other places, it's even worse. What is your? I know the success rate of people who are trying to kick a heroin addiction is very, very low. So one mother, a mother I know of a child who passed away from the heroin overdose, she was talking to me not too long ago about how it was as low as 1% ever really get totally off. What are your, in your experience, what kind of success are you having, or your practice having with even the most worst drug problems that we have in the country right now, which is heroin?
And that's usually the toughest drug to quit, absolutely. I really can't say exactly what our relapse rate is. We lose track of some people. Sometimes they don't call us back, not because they've relapsed and they're embarrassed, which does happen. Sometimes they don't want to be reminded of that part of their past, and they choose not to contact us. We respect that. We are in touch with a lot of people who are living successful lives now and are continuing to be grateful, and they come back and keep us informed of what's going on in their life. So I really can't tell you exactly what our stats are. Someone else in the clinic probably could. My job is to treat people. And interesting you mentioned heroin, because yes, it is frightening. I think it was like close to 20,000 deaths from overdose, the latest statistics I read, which was like 2014. That's shockingly high.
Yeah.
And I'm so thrilled that Obama is putting measures in effect now to treat this as a public health issue, so it's not a criminal activity or treated as a character flaw. We've got to get past that judgment and get people the real help they need. And when you're talking about heroin, it's really fascinating because that's, you know, an opiate, and that's very similar to the drug classification of hypnotics. So actually, hypnosis is a wonderful modality because whoever's been addicted to heroin loves that sense of euphoria and escape and relief from anxiety. So we can allow them to gravitate toward the very escape that they want in a natural, healthy way without harming the brain or the body.
So you get that euphoric sense, that release sense in a state of hypnosis?
I wouldn't say you get euphoria, but you certainly get a relief from anxiety.
Wow.
And further still, that's one thing we accentuate. We also reinforce in hypnotic trance in the treatment. I reinforce the ego strength. So clients have an ability to process any negative events or feelings in their life without just trying to escape them. Look, nobody chooses to be an addict. Nobody chooses to be a heroin addict. They've gravitated toward it to escape some sort of pain, either trauma, or certainly it could be because it's glamorous and it's chic and they're trying to fit in. This happens with a lot of teenagers because, as you probably know, the developing teenage brain can be a mess.
Mm-hmm.
There's the neuronal pruning that's going on, not only in the rest of their body with puberty changes, but their brains can be sort of a train wreck too. And it's that frontal cortex that's forming the decision-making centers. So when drugs are mixed into that, it can really wreak havoc. But there is a need for them to mimic others' behaviors because those mirror neurons are growing in. So what we want to do is separate that and have them create how they do want to face life and reassure them that they can deal with any sort of rejection or loss or failure without having to escape, without it being the end of the world.
And my last question of the night would be, now all of your hypnosis techniques, is that mainly without the use of drugs? Do you do drugs, play any role in your therapy, or do you like to do things a little bit more on this side of things, you know, the hypnosis side?
Well, I'm not a medical doctor, and when they come to Seasons, they are under the care of about 3 medical doctors, definitely an internist and a psychiatrist, who definitely will check them out. Many people do need antidepressants, anti-anxiotics. They may be bipolar. They have all sorts of mental disorders that I'm not about to touch. I fully respect that.
Right.
Hypnosis can work in conjunction with that. Absolutely.
That's amazing. And now, where can people find you? What other work are you doing right now that people might be able to reach out, ask questions, find out a little bit more about, you know, how any of this information can benefit them?
Absolutely. They can reach me at the seasonsmalibu.com website, loaded with information, or they can go to my own personal website and contact me from there, and that's very simply drnancyirwin.com. That's D-R-N-A-N-C-Y. IRWIN.com.
Dr. Nancy, thank you. So, where are you from originally? You got a very nice southern twang.
You heard it. Yeah. I'm originally from Atlanta, but I've been in California like 20 years now, but nobody told my mouth.
It's okay. It's all good. I'm telling you, that accent just calms me right down. I'm sure you cut right through to your patients. So thank you so much for the time. I can't wait to, I would love to have you on again.
Anytime, Frank.
Okay. Fantastic. Thank you so much for the time tonight, Doctor.
A pleasure.
Take care.
Be well.
And another one. Thank you, Dr. Nancy. Matt, what do you think? You want to get hypnosis?
Sure, why not?
You know, my problem with hypnosis has always been the heart is willing, but the mind won't let me do it. Like, I really want to get hit.
You can't get hypnosis.
I want to go under hypnosis. I want to do it. I'd love to feel that state of relaxation and have somebody, you know, work me through things with a little bit less of a guarded nature. I'd love that shit. Only thing is that whether I'm in front of somebody and I'm alone in a room, or whenever, you remember our buddy Michael Kirshner who came by and did all that, the magic? He did a lot of hypnosis stuff too. And I just can't take it seriously. Not so much I can't take it seriously, I don't believe it's going to work. So therefore, my mind continues staying active, questioning him. No, this is not happening, is it? Is it happening now? Maybe I'm getting relaxed. Do I feel something? It's like, that's my dialogue as it's happening. And then a couple of minutes goes by, I'm like, oh, shit. Still nothing's happening. Let's just keep the eyes closed and pretend that something's happening so they don't feel useless.
You should just get really stoned so this way you won't be thinking. Be in the zone. Yeah. But you better watch out because she can hypnotize you and do some MLK Ultra shit.
MLK? Martin Luther King Ultra? Martin Luther King Ultra. Watch out for that. I don't know. I'm all over the place tonight. That's what happens to me when somebody tries to hypnotize me. I generally sit there and I start thinking, all right, well, I don't want this person to look like a failure. I don't want them to look bad. I really don't want them to look bad. I want this to work just because I don't want them to look bad. I start feeling bad for the hypnotist when they're trying to hypnotize me. That's why I'm happy for people to have it work for them. I don't doubt its usefulness. I just think that I'm not capable as an individual.
I don't think, like, you're talking, remember when Gypsy got
Gypsy, you can tell Gypsy was acting along with that.
Did you ever ask him?
Yeah, I said, were you feeling it? And he looked at me and went, honestly, no. But I he didn't have to tell me that, man. I was watching him. He looked like he closed his eyes, and he was trying to be like reverent, like he was in church. You know? He was just, I can tell that he was just being reverent. That's it. Johnny Broom says Frank's a mob boss, so he has a hired gun when he's getting hypnotized, ready to kill everyone if he spills the beans. Nikki says, it's Matt standing in the corner.
Yeah. Matt's in the corner of every hypnosis session I go into. Just make sure that I don't divulge any information. It's 7:40. I want to call Alex Plitz in a couple of minutes. So the Skype is on. Here's a couple of things I wanted to put out there right off the bat. I want to get this out. And I also have Alex Plitz's latest article for the IJ Review. We might be able to spill over into 8 o'clock because Broken Filter Live is not going live tonight. So we might be able to spill over into that 8 o'clock hour a little bit more. Here we go. Number one, things that I was thinking during the debate last night. They didn't touch immigration. No, did not touch immigration, which is probably Trump's strong suit. And Hillary Clinton is an advocate for wide open borders. They did not touch, no mention. You want to talk about Lester Holt? No mention of the emails, aside for whatever Trump can squeak out on his own. Okay? No mention of Benghazi. Other people have noted this before today. You can probably find all of these all over the place, but just what I was gathering when we were watching. No mention of the Clinton Foundation or the State Department. None of that. No mention of the Iraq War, unless they were asking Donald Trump. Holt also grilled Trump on the birther shit and his bankruptcies and why he hasn't released his tax returns. So you leave out things of substance for things that are designed only to attack Donald Trump. So even as a person who's not a Trump supporter per se, but doesn't want Hillary to win at all, I'm sitting there going, this is unbelievable. But still, he powered through the first 30 to 40 minutes like a champ. And she was just weak. Weak. The woman was weak. Now, she finished strong, but not because she had anything good to say. In fact, she was embarrassing with some of her retorts and some of her angles that she was working and all that stuff, her pauses, her trying to show signs of emotion, being some kind of a human being. That is ridiculous. The only reason why Trump tailspun at the end was not because Hillary suddenly caught a second wind and the cocaine, the drip kicked in and she got some kind of a second wind.
Dude, I think she had something. She probably had something. She was pushing a button and it would inject adrenaline into
her. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised.
At the time, she was like...
Dude, she was very lethargic. She looked very, very weird. Okay? She stood up and she didn't cough for 90 minutes. Good job.
And she also didn't take one sip of water.
Yeah, well, in either case, he was the only thing that happened to himself. He spun out of control. He started talking himself into circles, and it was a little uncomfortable. I was like, oh, God, he hasn't stopped. Stop him. Stop him.
It's still the first
debate. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. He's missing opportunities. What else? So you had that. Holt also quieted the crowd down when they cheered for Trump, allowed the crowd to respond and cheer for Hillary, though. I don't know. You know, we also spoke about this yesterday. She was going to bait him. She baited him with the father's $14 million. That was the first thing. And then compared that to her own middle-class hero of a father. Who, at that point, I was saying, please hold your tongue, Donald. Do not go after her father. Do not attack the father. Don't do it. Thankfully, he didn't. But he started to stir, and I'm thinking to myself, why didn't he immediately bring up, and this also was brought up elsewhere today too, immediately, why didn't he bring, you're talking about $14 million that he turned into billions, despite the fact that he had to file bankruptcy from time to time? When you're in as many ventures as he is, don't you expect some failure? I don't get that. And I'm not over here. I'm not a Trump shill. I'm just looking at this from a business standpoint. You know, anybody would have abandoned the business that we have over here a long time ago. You want me to be completely honest? 10 years of broadcasting and finding ways of paying rent and utilities, it's just because we love it. It's just because we didn't want to do it at home anymore. Yes, we're trying to piece things together to turn this into a cohesive network, but be very honest. Anybody else would have looked at our investment and the things that we were doing and saying, how much are you spending? How much are you taking in? No. on to the next thing and cut it off. Bankruptcy, closing up shop, in so many words. Okay, so I understand that. I understand the way that the ebbs and flows of business. He had the opportunity of being involved in hundreds of businesses. That shit is just going to happen. So to think that $14 million that Donald Trump eventually turned into I don't know how many billions, and he didn't immediately jump all over the fact that Chelsea Clinton lives in a $10 million apartment in New York City, the same apartment that Hillary Clinton had to flee to when she collapsed on September 11th. Where did she get that money? The Clinton Foundation. Where are any of these people getting their money? You're talking about people helping their kids out? John Kerry just got busted for squeezing through $9 million, funneling through $9 million worth of contracts to his daughter. Chelsea's at a $10 million apartment. When the Clinton Foundation go, when the Bill and Hillary die, and all of their where are all those inheritances going to? Is anybody going to go and attack Chelsea Clinton for inheriting money that was made not in the private sector? See, that's the thing that kills me. It kills me. He didn't bring up the fact that Chelsea is going to be a major beneficiary of her parents' public sector wheeling and dealing fortune. They have made a fortune over providing no services or products that people want, and only pretended and faked it till they made it, with having people believe that they actually need them for social justice, for equality, for this and that, like they're working for them and they're not lining their own pockets. He didn't bring up that her income inequality speaking fees on college campuses are over $250,000 for a half hour. And he didn't bring up the fact that giving someone money doesn't mean shit. If you're wise, it will grow. But anybody could burn through $14 million in the matter of a year, less than a year, on bad investments and just lavish spending. Putting a big amount of money into somebody's lap is not the recipe for success, my friends. And this is when I'm sitting back watching these people talk to each other on television and trying to pin each other down. I'm like, oh my God, put me in his ear. Let me do this. Frank, there's 80 to 100 million people. You know how nervous? Like, no. This is just things that you have an opportunity to say something. Do it. You know, do it. Sorry, everybody. Wait a second. Let's put up the music a little bit. It's a really great song. No, but in either case, that's what was going through my mind.
We're just like other people. We love to sing, we love to dance.
That's what was going through my mind the whole time.
I hope he's just saving some of this venom for the second and third debate.
Here's the other thing. The grilling and the follow-up questions on how to bring back companies. You know, let me get to Alex Blitz on the phone. Because I'll just bring this up while
that had to be... Maybe that was a Hillary Clinton double.
Could be.
Hello.
Hey, Alex Plitzis, how are you? It's Frank.
Frank Valburo. What's
yes,
going on,
you are on. Quite frankly, once again, you're here with Matt, myself, the viewing audience at home, and we're just starting to dive into
greatest
this.
People alive.
They are. They definitely are, and they're growing. I can't believe it. I love it. Now, I'm gonna put a couple of thoughts out there. I want you to run with it because this can go anywhere. I haven't read your article yet because we've just been pressed for time. But last night, I just went through a couple of the other things that I was thinking about as far as this debate. But one thing that came up for me last night, the grilling and the follow-up questions on how to bring companies back home. And having Trump out there saying, they'll come back, oh, they'll come. I want somebody to say, that, you know, why can't they simplify anything and say something like, they'll be more inclined to come back when you drop the tax rate from 33% to 15%. They'll be less inclined to leave if you have it 15 instead of 33. Why are we still doing this caveman talk, this no clarity, this vague bullshit? Why are we still doing this stuff? Well, it's so easy, I feel, that all these follow-up questions can be completely neutralized, but it's like watching ballerinas dance.
Yeah, it was pretty obnoxious last night. I thought the same thing, too. I mean, he started down two roads that definitely made sense where he was headed with the first being the Iraq war bit with her Secretary of State, you know, that helped form ISIS and this and that. And she said, well, you know, Bush was responsible for the withdrawal. That wasn't me. And then she just sort of with a one sentence ended the ended the debate. Whereas in reality, you know, she was asked to relook at as well what the Department of Defense was, and then she was asked to renegotiate that status of force agreement that she spoke about, couldn't do it, and we withdrew all U.S. forces. He could have slammed her on that one and more directly connected her to the vacuum that helped to create ISIS.
So when you
and then again afterwards,
so you're saying that
one more.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. There was one more, just real quick, and at the end, it was about experience. Yeah, she's got experience, but it was bad experience, and it's. If you go back to all the convention speeches and all the stump speeches that all the senior politicians of the Democrat Party have made in support of Hillary Clinton, it has been about her experience as Secretary of State, as First Lady, as Senator, how she's been as close to the presidency as possible. You know, she's seen the decision-making apparatus up close, and therefore she's the most qualified based on experience. But it's never experience based on her accomplishments. Like, she wasn't there as a spectator. It's not like she was in the in the Situation Room in the galley observing what was going on. I mean, she was a participant at the table. And, you know, she's got a series of very bad decisions with piss-poor outcomes, from Iraq to China to Russia to the Iran deal to Syria to Libya. I mean, you name it. And he let it slip through. And I was just watching, and I couldn't tell whether he wasn't quick enough on his feet or whether or not he really just wasn't well-versed enough in the policy to make those comeback hits.
He's got it definitely just displayed a lot of unpreparedness, because for somebody like myself or anybody who just reads the news as best as I can, for anybody like us, I mean, you were on the inside for a very long time until recently. I mean, so you should know all this stuff, but we're sitting around last night. We had about 8 or 9 people over here watching the debates, and we're answering these. We're rebutting for him. How the hell is everybody else know this stuff except him?
Well, yeah, and I can understand, like, to a certain extent. Last night was supposed to be a national security focused debate, which it wasn't. I mean, Lester Holt. We ended up talking about Rosie O'Donnell, taxes, and then the birtherism, which had nothing. None of that had anything really to do with national security. So I could see if he flubbed a bunch of those follow ups. And blame that on being unprepared, because, like you said, I was on the inside for a while. He wasn't. But this is a billionaire businessman. And, you know, whether people want to criticize the taxes or not, you can run around the world and walk to, you know, $1 billion worth of real estate that's got his name on it that he definitely owns. So no matter whether he's filed for bankruptcy or whatever else, there's something tangible. So that the initial question that you raised, you know, about, you know, bringing U.S. companies back and, you know, lowering the tax rates and this is how you do it. If anything, that should have been an area where he should have been strong based on his experience. And he flubbed that one, too. That's, again, why I can't figure out what, you know, is it because he's unprepared, since it is an area that he's familiar with, or was he really just not that quick on his feet? And that's where I was kind of left wondering last night.
Yeah, yeah. And it was really, really disconcerting in that sense. But, you know, going back to what you said about Hillary Clinton, so last night she said that security agreement with Iraq, it wasn't something that was renewed by Iraq. You are saying that the real reason behind that is because she failed to renegotiate it. It was a failure on her part.
Yeah, so you can't have U.S. troops operating anywhere around the world in somebody else's sovereign country without an agreement from that nation state. I mean, that's an invasion otherwise. So we've got U.S. troops in dozens of countries around the world, and we sign pretty standard agreements called a security agreement. And the country or a status of force agreement, depending on if you're in an area of hostilities or it's a peaceful ally like Germany. And it stipulates the arrangements under which your forces are there, which includes like prosecution under local law. in most countries, you know, in particular places like Saudi Arabia, where you can get your hand cut off for stealing, you know, we want U.S. forces to be subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is stricter for things like murder and rape. Like, you can get the death penalty for rape in the military. You can't get that for, you can't get the death penalty in a civilian court, and you don't get all your same constitutional rights while in uniform. It was right after the Blackwater killings, not that long afterwards, that the Iraqis balked at signing a security agreement that would have allowed U.S. forces to be to remain under the Uniform Code of Military Justice and not subject to Iraqi prosecution. So at that point, they were woefully underprepared to, you know, take over security, which we at the Pentagon had noted, and me in Iraq at that time anyway. And
you were stationed. You were still stationed overseas when this happened. I said, I'm sorry. You were still stationed overseas when all this happened.
I was. Yeah, I was at the headquarters at U.S. Forces Iraq in 2010 when the task came down to evaluate whether or not we should remain under the Bush timetable for withdrawal, because rightfully so, you know, that, as Hillary noted last night, the initial decision to draw down U.S. forces had been made several years earlier by the Bush administration, and a timetable for withdrawal was set under pressure from Congress. And Obama came in, and as any good new president would do, he's going to review the, you know, strategic decisions like that made by his predecessor. So a task came down that said, hey, review the status of whether or not we need to leave U.S. forces behind, you know, with the timetable. And U.S. forces Iraq came back through Central Command headquarters, and we told the White House, you need to leave 10,000 U.S. troops behind in Iraq. The Iraqis are not ready to take over security for their own country. They're ill-prepared. They're not trained. And we're worried about al-Qaeda making a resurgence. We had all but beaten them into a pulp, but there were still factions left around. I mean, don't forget, we still have forces in Germany, Japan, and Korea 50 and 60 years after those conflicts, or 60 and 70 are done. So it's not like it's out of the realm of reasonable to leave forces there.
So
you withdraw everybody. You don't have intelligence collection. You don't have counterterrorism. You have nothing.
What was the
state?
So
we sent that to the White House.
You said
the White House said, go ahead.
Sorry. I wanted to know what the state. You said that the state of al-Qaeda at that time was decimated?
Oh, they were decimated. They were still small elements, you know, running around, very, very tiny. They were basically in hiding. They couldn't operate in the open. We had gotten most of their leaders and gone after them, but they weren't done. It's like putting out a fire, but they're still smoldering embers. Mm-hmm. Like, you need to watch those things, you know, and basically be able to be prepared to react to them before they relight the fire. And, you know, we noted, we said, hey, we didn't 100% eliminate the threat. We're not claiming that we completely defeated them, but they were beaten to the point where they were in submission and they were no longer like a threat to stability in the country. And wow. The White House acknowledged that, and they attempted to engage the Iraqis. And at that point, Iraq was more in need of U.S. money and U.S. security than any nation in the world, to include the several dozen that we had these security agreements in place with. And yet somehow they were unable to close the deal, the Obama administration. And, you know, Hillary was unable to negotiate with her counterparts as our chief diplomat. And the Iraqis balked, and her and the president basically looked at that as an opportunity to fulfill a campaign promise to get us out of Iraq. So instead of leaving any forces behind, by the end of 2011, every single U.S. combat force was withdrawn from Iraq. There was no one left behind. We have tens of thousands of troops in Germany, Japan, and Korea 70 years later, and less than 5 years after, you know, the main fighting in Iraq had sort of subsided with the surge, we withdrew everyone. There was nobody left. It defied common sense. It defied the advice of the military, and it came as a result of an inability to secure a revised security agreement, which fell on Hillary's lap. And Trump could have slammed her for that last night, and he didn't.
You got to go, and you have to run for Trump. You have to run for him. You have to be up there. You have to be the one saying this shit on television, Alex. How do we get you up there?
That would be an interesting position to find myself in.
God damn it.
Oh. I mean, because at this point, I still don't know what Mr. Trump's position is with regard to ISIS or some of the others. I haven't seen a coherent policy narrative or anything in detail enough to really get up there and defend him. It's one thing to be able to, you know, attack Hillary for her record and her piss poor decision making. And I understand you don't want to give details of a policy proposal to go after ISIS, like really nitty gritty detail, but you've got to give the American people some idea of what's going on. And you also got to give, you know, policy experts in certain areas enough information to either be able to support or defend the position you're taking. So he's left himself flapping in the breeze. There's no way that anybody can sort of support him. And he's open to jabs from Hillary, who's interpreting his lack of policy detail as not having a plan, which is what she charged him with last night.
This is a perfect segue into my last thought that I was having. It started with the bringing American businesses back home and the corporate tax rate and all that stuff. But, you know, someone on Twitter who absolutely gushes over Donald Trump, he's not just a, hey, listen, I know how bad Hillary is. I don't care what people say. I'm just going to pull the lever for Trump. He's not my guy, but I cannot be for her. He's not one of those people. He's somebody who gushes over Trump like he is George Washington. And he talks about his brilliance all the time, tells me that I don't understand the guerrilla mindset. Well, I told him that's not true. I know exactly how guerrillas think, but guerrillas have been decided since he was bullying Jeb Bush to the brink of tears during the primary debates. The guerrillas already knew they were going to be voting for him from the very beginning. Right now, these debates are only going to affect, the only people they're going to affect are some of the undecideds. And I would have to imagine right now that the undecideds this late in the game, they just need a little bit of clarity from somebody. And they're theirs. Where the fuck is the clarity?
It's not there. And, I mean, the other issue is that despite bad decision-making, you do have a woman who spent 30 years in the American political arena who is well-versed in the nuances of policy. Whether or not she's made good decisions and, you know, the results of those may not be good. You know, if you're somebody like Donald Trump who's been a businessman his entire career and is not well-versed in, you know, Federal Reserve or tax policy or how intelligence collection works or the military, but you've got an idea of what it is that you want, and in business, you know, as an executive, you set goals and you hold your people accountable to it. You know, a debate of this nature where you're basically being grilled on policy level detail is not his strong suit. Yeah. You don't want to take on a 30-year career politician like Hillary Clinton on substantive policy issues when you don't know what the hell is going on at that level. You know, she really is kind of a policy wonk, even if her positions happen to be wrong.
So in your latest article with the IJ Review, you list the 11 topics that Lester Holt could have touched on. I want to get a screen capture over here.
Actually 10. I think my editor had a beer this afternoon.
Okay. Okay, so then number one, the Iraq War. We talked about that a little bit. We already got that out of the way. Number two, the Iran nuclear deal. He mentions it on the campaign trail. He didn't bring it up. Trump didn't bring it up at all last night. I know this is supposed to be about Holt, but he didn't touch anything, like nothing.
He brought up in just nuance, like you're saying again, Frank. It was like just in these little jabs, but not enough to go for the kill. He said, "Oh, and the deal was a disaster." Yeah, it was a disaster. The administration got caught giving hundreds of millions of dollars to the Iranians in cash in violation of the law. You know, the Iranians have been found to be violating the sanctions, and they retain the enrichment technology that's used to produce a weapon system in addition to medical research equipment. So in the end, we just kicked the can down the road. It didn't even solve anything, and then gave them money to finance terrorist operations, you know, through groups like Hezbollah, who are currently operating in Syria, supporting the forces our U.S. Special Forces are fighting against. I mean, it's complete asinine nonsense.
Number three is the veterans. There was not a single question posed about how either candidate planned to take care of our nation's veterans. You know the biggest slap in the face as I'm watching this, I'm looking at this list over here, just between the Iran nuke deal and the Iraq war, Afghanistan war, the sequester, the national debt, China, Libya, all this stuff, the emails. We talked about all the other things that they didn't bring up before that they could have brought up. All of that stuff left out. It's not so much now, if I'm saying this, I hope people can take... You take me as being sincere, because I'm not just saying this to say it. But if I were a Democrat, I would be upset with talking about Rosie O'Donnell and all that stuff as well, too. Wouldn't you want to believe that your candidate beat somebody on all of the issues that are really important and that, you know, they won or lost by that merit? Why the fuck are we talking about pop culture last night? Why are we doing all this bullshit, running after... It's like we were chasing ghosts. It's so... I don't know, man. It's insulting.
I think you're 100% right. I mean, Hillary Clinton voted in favor of the Iraq war, and then we just talked about how she screwed up, you know, the security agreement, revising it when we recommended leaving forces behind. And yet the only question about the Iraq war that came up was to Donald Trump. He had some ambiguous interview with Howard Stern. So we're getting questions to one candidate based on an interview we did with Howard Stern with an ambiguous answer 15 years ago versus a sitting United States senator who single-handedly lost the last primary election to Barack Obama because of that issue, and she doesn't get a fucking question on it.
That's it.
Like, oh, was this Narnia last night? Like, this wasn't America. I don't know what the hell country that was last night. This debate was hosted in, because it was nonsense.
You're 100% right. I forgot completely about it. That was really the main glitch in her running against Barack Obama in 2008. You know,
she was the one who took the question. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. It's unbelievable. But that's another thing. Trump didn't turn that around. There was no presence of mind for that as well.
He also failed in that regard there.
That could have been
overall,
a body slam
like,
moment.
There were little mentions of some of this other stuff. You know, there were little mention of the Iran deal here real quick from Trump. The one word that never left anybody's mouth last night was Afghanistan. I mean, you realize this is the longest war in the history of the United States. The longest war in our country's history that is being waged in response to the single largest, deadliest terrorist attack against U.S. civilians in our history, where U.S. forces are still engaged in a fight overseas. And during a debate about national security, there wasn't a single question and neither candidate mentioned it. That there's something seriously fucking wrong with that.
Oh, so now what do we do? Next debate, who even cares? Now what do we do? This is really just what's on the line here, man. There's nothing of substance anywhere.
No, there really wasn't. And, you know, there were a couple of critiques of Lester Holt. You're talking about the next debate. You know, and some of them were based on his style, whether or not he interrupted Trump too many times versus Clinton, whether or not he asked softball questions of Clinton and was too hard on Trump. And there's arguments, I think, being made from both sides in support or countering all of those arguments. I really think the real argument needs to be based on substance. He failed to ask meaningful questions related to the topic at hand. And, I mean, it's hard to control Donald Trump. Look at the way he behaves. I mean, there were a lot of articles posted today where they said, you know, this is going to be shown in gender studies classes for forever, and he's picking on a woman. I watched him do that exact type of behavior, talking over, interrupting, stealing time, and being kind of a jerk to 16 men and one woman, Carly Fiorina, in the Republican primaries.
Yep.
Now, the people writing all these articles today were liberals who probably didn't watch those debates. So he's an equal opportunity offender. He's just kind of an asshole. That's just who he is.
Mm-hmm.
So no moderator is ever going to control him. But the questions need to really be substantive and important in the next few debates to really inform the American people, or else they are going to fail us.
Well, Alex, thank you once again for the call. I'd love to have you on again soon. This is only going to accelerate until November 8th, and then I can't wait until November 10th, because the 9th we'll go over some stuff, and then the 10th I'm going to start reading fiction books again and just start, you know, I don't know, wasting away. At least I'm going to try to talk about nothing but Star Wars for the rest of the holiday season, and then we'll start talking about this again once the inauguration pops up.
Will there be a, quite frankly, election night special?
Oh, yeah, we got to. You were a huge – actually, that was the first time you ever called into one of our broadcasts. It was on the 2012 election night special, and that was a very well put together night.
God, your audience has been suffering with me for that long?
4 years, man.
Those poor people, I apologize. It's all, the time of your life you won't get back
for
me.
It's all good. It's all good, man. Listen, if you don't say it, they're not getting this type. Nobody's getting this type of breakdown anywhere else, especially not on television. So I consider you a great asset as well as a friend. So you got to start coming by more often, man.
Let's do it, brother. Let's plan an election night special then.
All right, dude. I'll talk to you in a little bit.
All right, Frank.
Later. Shit. I always cut people in the middle of that last thing that they say. Oh, God. All right, guys. Well, listen, that's all for tonight. At 9 o'clock, we're going to come back on air, I think. We're going to come back on air at 9 o'clock. You guys, we'll see you then. You'll hang out. We'll talk about things that are completely apolitical. There you go. Nikki, I always see people quoting me now. I guess they caught on to the fact that I say in either case a lot, is that in either case, I don't give a fuck. I don't give a fuck. I do say that as well. I'm giving less and less of a fuck. But everybody, I like not giving a fuck with you guys. Because it's either I say this to somebody, or I say this in a shower later, feeling like I'm going nuts. And I hope you know you can call in and you can say, listen, I just don't give a fuck anymore. Okay? So you guys don't have to go and complain in the shower by yourself as well. You can, by all means. I hope you have a great night. Thank you, Dr. Nancy Irwin, for joining us. Thank you, Alex Plitzis. And we'll see you guys tomorrow night, 7 o'clock for this show. And then later on tonight, 9 o'clock, actually in 50 minutes or so, we'll go on for about 15, 20 minutes. So, guys, if you have any funny clips or things that you want us to talk about, come back for the 9 o'clock. And also, send me hypothetical situations you want me to sift through on air. I love getting hypothetical questions and all that stuff. Send me hypotheticals. That could be a new bit for the show. But I want that to be generated by the users, by the friends in the chat room and all that stuff. Email it to me, frank@zenlive.tv. Send me a Tumblr message, a Tumblr ask. It could be anonymous, a tweet. Send me something hypothetical things, okay? I like doing hypotheticals. They lead to great things. All right, talk to you soon, guys. Couple minutes, 9 o'clock.